This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Now, a topic that everybody experiences, but not everybody wants to talk about, bloating. Some people experience bloating for a whole variety of reasons, including ones that might surprise you. Swallowing air, for example, can be one reason behind bloating.
And bloating is something that can be uncomfortable, and it can also be a sign that there's something wrong with your digestive health. Our next guest says gastrointestinal health is really crucial to our overall health and our happiness and well-being.
Dr. Robin Chutkin is back with us now to talk about her new book. It's called The Bloat Cure, 101 Natural Solutions for Real and Lasting Relief. She's a gastroenterologist and the founder of the Digestive Center for Women. Dr. Chutkin, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Robin and Veronica. It's great to be back.
So when we first started talking about this topic at one of our meetings, people were wondering, well, what exactly is bloat? So let's start there. How do you define what bloat is?
So it refers to an excess of gas and air in the digestive tract. It can be fluid also, but generally when we think of bloating, we think of excessive air in the digestive tract that leads to increased abdominal girth and, as Rob said, a lot of discomfort.
And I think a lot of people probably experience this and think, it is what it is. I've got this. There's not much I can do about it. And if I read one main point from your book, you're saying, no, if you do some work, if you do some searching, you can find a cause and probably a solution.
Absolutely. The goal of the book was to allow people to be a little bit of a medical detective when it comes to their bloating and to figure out what's causing it. Is it something you're eating? Is it a medication you're taking? Is it hormonal imbalance? Is it something anatomical? There are lots of things that conspire to bloat us, and there are lots of things we can do about it.
Well, do you think in the pantheon of things that can be wrong with a person, things that can go wrong with the human body, there's lots of them. Why should we worry about bloating?
Well, it's a sign that all is not well in the digestive tract. You know, there's so many things that affect the GI tract. When you think about it, everything that you ingest eventually ends up in the GI tract. Medications are metabolized through the digestive tract. Even things we put on our skin can end up in our digestive tract. So there, you know, it's a way of our body giving us important feedback through the gut that all is not well. And so it's important to take heed and not just ignore it.
Let's look through your book now. You've got a lot of causes, like 100 or so causes potential of bloating. I'll list it alphabetically. Why did you set up the book that way?
Well, again, I wanted it to be easy for people to use, Rob. I love this idea of medical detectives, of, you know, kind of rolling your sleeves up and figuring out what's going on, and also figuring out when you might need some professional help. So I do emphasize with some of the diagnoses what I call the red flag or alarm signs that could be a sign of something more serious, whether a form of cancer, serious infection, that kind of thing. And fortunately, those are the exception rather than the norm. But I wanted it to be easy for people to use. So going through it A to Z makes it a little bit easy and maybe even a little bit fun as you think about it.
Well, let's look at the very first letter of the alphabet, your first entry, A, acid reducers. Now, this is something that affects a lot of people, lots of people taking acid reduction medications. What does that have to do with bloat?
It has a lot to do with bloat. So there's been a lot of information in the media recently about these class of acid-suppressing drugs, particularly the proton pump inhibitors, a little purple pill, and so on, being linked to kidney disease and dementia and heart disease. But they really disrupt digestion. So having acid in the stomach to help break food down and to create the exactly right pH for digestive enzymes to work is an integral part of digestion. And when you change that as profoundly as these drugs do by really changing the pH from acidic to alkali, you create a nice, friendly, hospitable environment for bacteria to overgrow in the upper GI tract where they really shouldn't be in very high numbers. And so you can get bacterial overgrowth. And what do bacteria do? They produce lots of bloating, hydrogen and methane gas and so on. So that's one way that these drugs contribute to bloating, but they also interfere with digestion. And so you can get improper and incomplete absorption of important nutrients like magnesium and calcium and iron, vitamin D. This can lead to osteoporosis. So in addition to bloating, there are lots of things that can happen when you stay on these drugs long term.
These are super commonly used medications for people who are thinking, okay, I'm taking this, maybe I can get away from it. The solution, as I understand it, is not just to throw the pills away and be done with them today.
Yeah, you have to be careful how you taper off these drugs, because when you block acid as efficiently and effectively as these drugs do, when you stop the medication, there can often be a surge of acid and an increase in your symptoms. So it's important to taper slowly. It's important to check with your doctor to see if you have a particular condition. Maybe you're at risk for esophageal cancer, some of these other conditions that might necessitate you still being on the drug. So it's important to do it with the supervision of your healthcare provider, but it's also important to push that healthcare provider to come off the drug. These drugs were initially approved really just for use for a couple months at a time to heal ulcers, but now we use them long term. I have patients who've been on these drugs for decades, and it's really messing up their digestion.
One of the other pieces of advice you give is to remember that your stomach has a bedtime. What do you mean by that?
The contractility of the gastrointestinal tract, particularly the stomach, is tied to the light-dark cycle, what we call the circadian rhythm. So as we're approaching the summer equinox now in the middle of June, getting towards it, it's getting dark later and later. So in D.C., where I live, at around this time a few months ago, it was pitch black, and now the sun is still shining through, poking through a little bit of clouds today. And so it changes over time. In the winter, the sun sets at about 5, 5:30, and in the summertime, that can be 8 or 8:30. And so your contractility changes. So in the winter, you really have to eat an earlier dinner. And in the summertime, we have the luxury of eating a little bit later, because once the sun sets, the contractility goes way down. And unfortunately, most of us are dumping the majority of our calories into our sleepy stomach that's barely contracting late at night when the sun is set. And to add insult to injury, we're also reclining shortly after that, so we don't have the benefit of gravity to help things get from north to south, and movement. We're sort of reclining and we're sedentary, so it's sort of a triple threat of the stomach's barely contracting, we don't have the benefit of gravity, and we're not moving to stimulate peristalsis, and that's just a major setup for bloating.
Talking to Dr. Robin Chutkan about her new book, The Bloat Cure, 101 Natural Solutions for Real and Lasting Relief. Well, Dr. Chutkan, you write that one reason we sometimes have air in our digestive system is that we're swallowing lots of air, and we can do that in a bunch of different ways. What are some of the things we should watch for?
This is one I love, aerophagia, because it's so common and it's so easily treatable. People have aerophagia sometimes because they have a deviated septum, but commonly, too, they have allergies and they're mouth breathers, particularly this time of year in the spring when the pollen counts are high. So if you're breathing through your mouth, you're more likely to be swallowing a lot of air. We also see this when people are talking on the cell phone and they're eating and they're talking fast, multitasking, doing a lot of different things, drinking while eating, and it can cause air to get swallowed. Instead of air going into your respiratory tract, it goes into your GI tract, and it really fills your stomach up. So by the end of the day, you can really feel like the Michelin man or woman and be full of air and have sort of a tense, uncomfortable digestive tract. People who have aerophagia often have a lot of burping, and that can be a sign if your abdomen is getting more and more distended as the day goes on and you're burping a lot, sucking on hard candy, chewing gum. These are things that can add to it. So one of the simplest things is just to really be mindful when you're eating, slow it down, and try not to drink and gulp a lot of liquids in between meals, and of course, spit out the hard candy and the gum.
No, I heard you say if you're the, you feel like the Michelin man or woman. Is it a man or woman thing? I feel like this is one of those things that women talk about a lot, and they've got a lot on their plates in terms of feeling pressure about their appearances. Do we have to add bloat to that list? Is it mostly women?
Well, you know, some of the things are equal opportunity employers, like the acid blockers and the aerophagia. But the real difference, Veronica, is that men have a built-in Sphinx in the form of their abdominal wall because of higher testosterone levels. So even a woman who works out a lot and has a well-developed abdominal wall typically doesn't have the same level of musculature in the abdomen. Men have, again, this built-in Sphinx holding everything in. So even a man who has a big bear belly will rarely complain of feeling bloated. He'll complain of feeling fat and having a bear belly. But underneath that bear belly, he tends to have a taut abdominal wall that's holding the bowels in and is less prone to bloating. Women also have longer digestive tracts. Our colon, on average, is about 10 centimeters longer, which might not seem like a lot, but that extra 10 centimeters leads to a lot of extra twists and turns, redundancy. And we also share space with our reproductive organs. In women, we have the bladder, we have the uterus, the fallopian tubes, the ovaries. There's a lot of hardware down there, and the bowels tend to get a bit squished. And so with the less room, there's more bloating. So those are some anatomical and hormonal reasons why women tend to have more bloating than men.
Let's talk about some of the food we eat. It's pledge drive time here. A lot of sugary substances show up at Wisconsin Public Radio. What's the impact of sugar and artificial sweeteners when it comes to bloating?
You're sort of darned if you do and darned if you don't, because sugar tends to feed the excessive sugar, not a little bit of dark chocolate here and there.
So three donuts, say, is not as fine.
Yeah, three donuts, for example, tends to encourage growth of the wrong type of bacteria and yeast species in the gut. And so when you develop imbalance between the good bacteria and the not-so-good bacteria, again, you get overgrowth and a lot of methane and hydrogen gas and a lot of uncomfortable bloating. Artificial sweeteners, though, are a particularly bad idea when it comes to the gut, because the reason they don't contribute calories is because they're not broken down and absorbed in the small intestine, where most carbohydrates are. So they float on down to the colon, where they get fermented by gut bacteria, and that fermentation results in a lot of extra gas and really uncomfortable bloating and gas. If you've ever had candy that's designed for diabetics or chocolate with a lot of artificial sweetener in it, you'll experience really bad gas and bloating with that. So I say calories over chemicals every time. Stick to regular sugar, but eat less of it, or even better, a little bit of organic raw honey, which has a lower glycemic index than table sugar and doesn't result in as much bacterial overgrowth.
And Dr. Chutkan, as we wrap up, we hear a lot about the promise of probiotics, and I think we're just sort of starting to figure out their potential and how to use them. But do you recommend a probiotic to help put your gut in good working order?
I recommend probiotics in particular situations and people who've had an infectious diarrhea where a lot of their healthy gut bacteria has been wiped out, or people who've been on a lot of antibiotics. There's certain conditions like forms of inflammatory bowel disease where probiotics have been proven to help. But a general probiotic for everyone, I'm not sure we can make a case for that. And it's really important to choose a probiotic appropriately. It needs to have enough live bacteria to actually do something, to make a difference. And it has to have typically several strains of bacteria because they all work together. So probably more important than a probiotic is avoiding antibiotics whenever possible and eating a plant-based diet that's rich in indigestible plant fiber, which will feed your existing bacteria and help you to grow a good gut garden.
Are there any particular plants that you recommend we eat?
There are foods that are high in a kind of fiber called inulin. So that's things like leeks and asparagus, artichokes, onion, garlic, oats are great, and anything with stringy fiber like celery. Those are all really great for gut bacteria.
We leave it there, Dr. Chutkan. Thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Dr. Robin Chutkan, gastroenterologist and founder of the Digestive Center for Women. She's the author of the new book, The Bloat Cure, 101 Natural Solutions for Real and Lasting Relief.